My name is Dora, and this is a podcast called Verified Geek. It's a podcast with guests that work or have worked in the tech industry. They share with me their journeys, thoughts, hobbies, and interests. Please join me. I'm very excited to welcome to the show two exceptionally talented web developers, Jeff and Dan. We talk about topics like, do you need a computer science degree to work as a programmer? How was working as a web developer in 1999? What happened to contracting in the UK? And is full stack development the new way to get a good job? And much, much more. Let's do this. Hi, Jeff and Dan. How are you today?
Oh, hi, Dora. No, good. Thank you very, very much. Yeah, good to see you. It is really good to see you.
How are you doing? How is London treating you? How's the lockdown treating you?
Lockdown's our favourite word, isn't it, right now? So at least we're inside and it's warm. Getting pretty lonely, getting pretty bored after, well, almost a year of just shunning everybody.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, we soldier on. Thank goodness for the likes of Zoom and for the likes of FaceTime and all of those video chat things that allow us to stay in touch with people. So it's okay. We've saved money by not going up to the restaurants and the pubs.
That is so true. I mean, I feel so bad about the people that lost their jobs, but for the people that can actually work from home, they're saving a lot of money. Yeah.
We're quite fortunate to be in the industry we're in, I think.
Just let the people know, you guys, I've worked with you guys a few years ago. You guys are both programmers. And all I have to say is that, you know, when you're new in a company and you have anxiety and you're a bit nervous the first few days, you always find some people to take good care of you and tell you, don't worry, we'll help you, there's time. And you guys were those people for me. That's why when I first thought of doing a programming podcast, I thought of you, because you taught me a lot of things and you were very welcoming in the company that we all work together. I'm just going to basically ask you some questions about your coding experience in life and what you're doing now and what's your opinion about some new technologies and stuff. So did you both study computer science or something else?
I studied computer science at Brunel. For my sins, I left before I got my degree, but so I'm degreeless. I don't regret that. So I basically the way the course is split up was 2 years of study, a year of work experience, and then the last year of study. So it was a 3-year course split over 4 years. And so I did the first 2 years, went on the work placement, and really decided, well, there were various factors, but the long and short of it was, you know, I stayed in the industry. And so by the time all my peers had finished their final year, I'd had an extra year in work. And I really don't regret that. So, I mean, I don't know whether certainly in this country, maybe in America it's different, but I don't know if needing a degree is necessary.
I
don't know about whether it's necessary or not. I think, I mean, I did get my degree. I studied in New Zealand, and while I studied computer science, due to the weird state, it was an arts as well as a science, it was classified as. My degree ended up by being an arts degree. So I have a BA, a Bachelor of Arts in Computer Science. I never, ever met anyone else who's got one of those. I can remember at the time thinking, what is the purpose of my degree? What have I really learned? Well, I learned how to write essays about computers, and I learned how, of course, you learn the fundamentals of a lot of programming languages, the building blocks that you can use to learn new languages as well. And that's kind of cool. But really, I just felt that the degree itself was an opportunity to do something, to commit to doing something for a long period of time, to follow it through, and to have the recognition to say that, yep, he's or they are prepared to do the work that they said that they were going to do, which kind of, I think that's what an employer is looking for. When they say, you know, they say, must have a degree of this level or X number of years and so on, I think they're just looking at a very, very light level anyway to see whether or not you can do what you say you're going to do. It. Can you stick with it? Or is this person maybe just not going to turn up after a few weeks? So I don't know. Different people, I think, would require a bit more guidance, I think, you know, and not every job's the same. Not every.
Yeah, I agree with you. You don't have to have a degree to get a job in this industry, but it kind of helps in some sectors. Like for me, I think it helps you thinking better in a way. And every single like month or every 6 months, there's a new technology you have to learn. And that's kind of what the university is teaching you. Like you need to learn something new, learn this, learn the basics, like you said. So in this industry, you kind of have to learn the basics of something new quite often. So I think it gives you some skills. You don't necessarily have to have a degree. And I had some wonderful bosses in my life that didn't have a computer science degree. They did have another degree. But I've also worked with people that had no degrees at all, and they're pretty good. But yeah, it does give you some exceptional skills. That's true. So what was your first job titles?
Other than paper, probably first serious job title would be, I think, IT support technician for me.
Okay.
So it wasn't a developer role. It was IT support, straight out of university into a, I suppose they had four offices split over the UK plus a few internationally, but I was supporting the four UK offices. So Oxford, Manchester, Scotland, London, about 500 people. Yeah. It was all Lotus Notes administration and no programming whatsoever.
Oh, a little bit different for me. I mean, I didn't get into programming at all. I graduated and then applied for a job at my university for the very same course I just graduated at, and was told I was overqualified. I couldn't never figure that out. So I ended up by working for a government grant organisation, a New Zealand group that was involved in teaching long-term unemployed people computer skills and life skills. So it was kind of, well, it wasn't really computer-based too much. We went to the gym and we learned how to budget and, you know, the sorts of things that maybe you and I take for granted. But my first real computery role was in the evil sales area, and I was a computer salesman, and I sold Apple computers to students and academics within my university area, but pretty much within the South Island of New Zealand. And I did that for a year before I got onto something else, which was then more like Dan, computer support mostly for the university that I graduated from. So it all stayed a little bit computer supporty until, well, about the age of 29, I moved from New Zealand over here to the UK and decided, well, I may as well start doing that stuff that I've got my degree for. And it was around about then that I started programming.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
And what was your, like, what was the language back then? What did you, what were the technologies that you were using when you first started?
Well, when I was first started, I started working here in London for a stamp company that collects stamps. Stanley Gibbons, I think. Yeah, big one on the high street in London. And really, it was just using HTML. It was using some kind of server-side scripting language to create CGIs.
FileMaker Pro, was it?
That wasn't used for that one, but I also used FileMaker Pro, which is an Apple database-y kind of a product. So it was all kind of driving into HTML, really low quality. It wasn't what I would consider even proper JavaScript. I didn't learn JavaScript till about 6 months later on the job at my next contract. And that's then what I ended up by using most of my contracting time.
Yeah.
So and you were... Go on.
Dan was just saying that when he...
By the time I started development, which was 1999, well, I mean, I'd been programming since I was a kid, really, but by the time Jeff convinced me to quit my job in IT support and go into web development, it was mid-99, and the dot-com boom was about, you know, everyone was talking about the new millennium and they wanted their website to, you know, showcase what they would be doing over the millennium and so on. And Jeff came home one day and said that if you can learn HTML over the weekend, you can come to work on Monday morning. And so, yeah, I got the O'Reilly book and just sat there and just learned over the weekend and then took the book to work with me on Monday morning.
Yeah, you did.
And just sat and they gave me work and I coded, and that was it. And that's, and I've been doing web development since then, since mid-99. Yeah.
Back then, what I refer to as the cowboy years, none of the employers really knew nobody really knew anything about programming, about front end, about HTML. They didn't even really have a concept of what JavaScript and what role JavaScript played in that whole stack. So you could kind of do whatever you want. The very fact that Dan didn't have a huge amount of experience didn't really matter, because you know, you could look it up in a book, or he could quickly nudge me on the side and say, "Hey Jeff, how do I do so and so?" And the cool thing, though, is it's important when you're learning is to learn. So you ask the question and then you learn. You're told an answer and you figure it out and then you apply it. Next time, you don't need to ask that question again. And maybe this is drawing back to conversation of the concept of learning and how to learn, and maybe, you know, some people need a degree to prove it to themselves and to others, whereas others just have been told how to learn or been taught how to learn. Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. So was it a contract or was it a permanent job?
It was a contract, wasn't it? It was, as Dan mentioned, it was just before the millennium that he started. Mm-hmm. And everyone was really worried about the year 2000 bug and how just the whole world was going to fall to pieces. And so there was so much concern over that. And if you can imagine with what you know now, really a Y2K bug, how's that going to break websites that really don't even have JavaScript? There's no back ends. It's just HTML. So we were kind of, you know, we were working in a very, very weird 2 or 3 month period there where no one really knew. The boss didn't know. No one knew that what you did or didn't know.
Yeah, I think they were more worried about critical systems than their websites, probably. But yeah. Fun times. It was a very fun time to be a developer, certainly, and a contractor.
So you basically, so you started doing contracting very, very early in the process. Did you, after that, did you ever have a permanent job, or were you always doing contracting?
Well, I haven't. I've only been contracting since I moved over here. So for me, it's been 20 odd years, and I haven't had a permanent job since making that move.
Wow.
That's a little bit different to Dan. It took me a long time to convince Dan to quit his very comfortable permanent job doing tech support, where, you know, obviously you weren't fulfilling your potential. So it took me ages to convince him to leave his permanent job, and then, crazy enough, it took me ages to convince him to consider going back into doing another permanent job.
So, 1996, I started the IT support job, and then finished in 99 to go contracting, doing development. But I've been contracting now until April last year, when the IR35 rules were basically going to come in, and which meant effectively the end of long-term contracting. And, you know, rolling contracts, because I was basically an employee. They basically, you know, I was being paid to turn up and they could just give me whatever work they wanted. There was no specific contract to say, you know, you're here for a set period of time to do a specific thing. So I would have fallen foul of IR35 rules. And most companies were getting rid of contractors because of this problem, because previously to date, it would be the individual contractor who might get fined, but now the rules are changing, so it was the companies themselves that would get fined, and nobody wants that. You know, it's a hot potato, you drop it. So,
right. Why did you think they applied that rule, and what happened to contracting and they decided to just stop it completely and bring in that regulation?
Well, from the IR35 rules were initially set up probably, I'm guessing here, about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they kind of had two sets of rules. The rules were applied to the private sector and to the public sector differently. Mm-hmm. So, and what we were told was that the public sector stuff, so we're talking, say, NHS contractors, they would be under the rules that are currently in place now, but they would see how that worked, and then they would apply that to the private sector. And the plan was to apply it from April last year. But what happened was, obviously, we had this COVID pandemic lockdown, and they ended up by pausing it
for a year.
Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, and I haven't checked right now, but I'm guessing that the rules that have applied to the public sector will now be applied to the private sector as of probably April this year.
Yeah.
Unless there's another change to that. And so they've spent some time bedding it in. And and I guess so the concept of contracting ending really now is it's crept in because of that, because of the move of the law change yeah. itself, I think. And it's most companies that are risk averse. They don't want to have the chance of IR35 coming down on them and auditing them because of some kind of employment issue or because of a contract that doesn't match the IR35 guidelines. So it's much easier for an organization just to employ somebody as a permanent employee rather than deal with that. Because if they get caught out, the fines and the costs are just too much. And so that's where we've seen. I mean, strangely enough, I was offered a contract out of the blue just yesterday from an agency and I think that they're representing more international clients now. So in the past, I would have ended up by working at a bricks and mortar company, probably here in London, going 9 to 5, much like a permanent employee. But with this lockdown, with the introduction of people working from home now, I've seen so many more jobs, and in fact, this job as well, coming from an overseas client wanting, don't really care anymore where they're working.
And it's fixed term though, isn't it? It probably doesn't fall foul of IR35.
That's right. It's a short-term contract. Right. So in fact, I don't think contracts did so much as now short-term. Much more short-term, probably not as tax efficient, I think is the phrase that we're supposed to use, as it once would have been. Yeah. So in actual fact, I think it's a combination of terms. But the tax man has been part of the problem, a big part of the problem. But obviously the risk averseness of most companies not wanting to get fined silly amounts of money, I think that's a big part of the problem too, or a big part of the cause anyway.
So you can still get into a contract, but it will basically be fixed term, short term, and the companies will have to be a bit more careful on that.
They have to do things like saying, well, we're going to employ Dora for a 3-month contract. Her roles and responsibilities will include this, this, and this, and these are the deliverables that we expect from Dora in this time frame. And we'll expect her to do this work at home or using her own hardware. Yeah. You need to come online and do Zoom calls with them. You may need to visit the office maybe once or twice a month.
Yeah.
But generally, it's more along the lines of, we've given you a task to do. You've got an X number of times to do it, and then you do it.
And it'll be a fixed deliverable as well. So rather than saying, let's say you come on to write, be a front-end developer, and you might do bingo, you might do slots, whatever. It'll be you've come on to do this brand of bingo game. You've got 3 months. There you go. It'll be very specific.
It basically no more than that. Okay, that makes sense. I was worried that it was actually banned completely. I didn't do my homework on the matter. So now I get it. Makes more sense. So in the new technologies that you're using, you've been doing web development just like I have, but lately, I haven't always been doing web development. I was also doing some Flash games and stuff in the past. But lately, most of the companies are asking from the developers to become full stack. What do you think about this? Do you think that you have to become full stack in order to get a good job these days?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think if you're at a company, quite a serious company, and you're in a serious role, they'll want people to specialize. So, I'm in a permanent role, you do a really good financial trading company, and they're very compartmentalized in terms of there can be some overlap, but you have the front end team, you have the middleware team, you have the database team, you have it's very everyone has their specialties, because I suppose otherwise they want to know they can go to this team and get a kick-ass server-side work or kick-ass front end work or whatever, and you might not get that necessarily with 5 full stack developers. I don't know. I mean, it's not a bad thing, full stack development.
So. You mentioned that your organization is a large organization. I mean, it is. It's a big company. So they've probably got the finances and the ability to have that breakdown. True. See, my personal opinion is that full stack development is a bit of a catchphrase that we tend to use only with recruiters or in business meetings. And whereas the reality is maybe to redefine it as we want – we're a large organization. We've got lots of money. We want people that are experienced in one particular or two particular areas, and then they have a good grounding of the rest. I think if you're looking at a smaller organization, maybe they don't have the budgets necessarily to be able to bring in a specialist architect or a specialist deployment or a person or a specialist anything. And so, in fact, having two or three people who have a good working knowledge or at least some experience in those areas makes sense. So maybe in a smaller environment or a smaller corporate, the concept of a full stack development it has a different meaning than in a larger organization where you've got more chance for specialists. So I don't think that you need to be what they call a full stack developer, but right. But by the same token, I really think that there's a lot of experience that you can get through learning how to use the tools that you require. Say, if you know do database stuff, you should probably have a little bit of an understanding of the tools that you might use to communicate with the database. If you're doing deployment, maybe have an understanding of the deployment tools that you're going to use, and know how to Google the stuff on Google or Bing or whatever you're going to choose to use. It's know what you don't know, but know how to search for it.
Yeah.
And admit to it. Because if someone were to say to me, look, Jeff, can you help me out? I want to build this new web app. I'd be foolish to say I could do absolutely everything. But I can probably knock something up pretty swiftly because I can use Google to help me on certain things. Is it going to be enterprise-y enough? Probably not. But if I was working for an enterprise, then they would probably be able to take a lot of what I start with and apply, you know, we'll get the back-end developers now to create some APIs for you, or with this information, maybe we'll bring in a designer. But, I don't think you need to have all of the experience to be a full-stack developer to have at all of the times. You can't be a jack of all trades, because you end up, as we say, you end up by being a master of none. So my specialty area is JavaScript. Front-end, CSS, HTML, but I do PHP and I do SQL, and the JavaScript doesn't necessarily have to be front-end, it can be back-end. And when it comes to a bit of graphic design work, I can kind of pull that off too. And if I have to, I could put a continuous integration thing together, and I can do a deploy pipeline. And, you know, do I enjoy doing those things? Well, not really, because that's not my specialist area, but I do enjoy doing it.
You do,
And that is my specialist area.
I think that's what the employers want to see, because I've been working with full stack developers that have become a full stack developers coming from front end background or server side background. So they are lacking in one of the two principles, but they do, like you said, know if the employer asks them to do it, they will do both jobs and they will do all of this. So yeah, I think you're right. It's more of the fact that you have to convince the employer that, listen, I can do it if you want me to do it, but I'm really good at front end development. Yeah, exactly. But I'm really good at front end development, and that's where I've been working on for all these years, and that's where I'm good at. But that's what I'm struggling with right now. Is like I am moving to full stack development, but I'm learning so much right now that I'm going to be quite slow when it comes to Node.js, or even though I know JavaScript and stuff, but I am quite slow in doing back-end stuff. Whereas if you give me a front-end thing, I just do it really quickly. So yeah, I think but if you look at like junior developers, they think that they have to know both perfectly. They have to be amazing at both of them, and they're actually struggling, and they're stressing out because they're just starting and they just got a job that's full stack, and they're like, oh, I need to do both of them perfectly. And I keep on telling them, you don't really have to. On the contrary, I would suggest find your passion now. You might actually enjoy just doing front end or just doing back end. Like development is not just full stack all the time. I know what you mean. So Dan, are you still working as a front end developer then?
Yes, absolutely. And there's certainly opportunity to transfer to other teams if you wanted to, say, try some iOS development or so on. But I'm very happy doing front-end development. Other people, you know, might want to do more of a team lead role or a mentor. But, you know, I'm just happy with my code. And I know, you know, I've been doing it forever and people say, oh, do you want to do a team lead role or, you know, so on. No, I'm just happy with doing what I do. I'm very fortunate that I've been doing it for a long time and I do love my job. A lot of people, you know, some for them, it might just be a job is a job and they don't like it. But, you know, I can't see myself stopping anytime soon, certainly.
Yeah, I'm very, very jealous on this. You're always very, very passionate. And sometimes, I mean, I love it as well, but sometimes I just hate it. it's not very frequent, so I'm happy. Now that we mentioned JavaScript, let's talk about how fast new frameworks and new libraries come to the scene. And let's talk about, you know, what are you doing right now? Are you working on React, Angular, or just vanilla JavaScript? What is it?
So at the moment, I'm working with Ember. I've been working with Ember since, I'm trying to think of how long. So I've been at IG for 3 years. Yeah, February 2018. And before that, PW using it for a good couple of years. So probably at least 5 years, I suppose. It was kind of a chance discovery, really. So another contractor was brought in to replace me while we went on holiday one Christmas. And he noticed that we were writing the same things again and again using jQuery. So we'd create a form, we'd wire everything up. He said, you know, there are frameworks that can handle all of this for you. And he happened to know Ember, he'd used it before. And so when I learned this new framework, and I've fallen in love with it. React was, I think, nowhere, I don't even think even early versions were out there at all. So there were, you know, quite a few things. They're doing similar jobs, you know. Yeah, so it gave you an MVC framework, exactly, Angular's, you know, MVC framework, data binding. So you didn't have to just keep writing the same boilerplate code. And it was great. It was a great time saver. It really was. And it gave some structure to your web app. And I think that was, for me, that was the thing. It was no longer just a collection of random HTML files and JavaScript files. You had some structure. You had your views, controllers, models, you know, data adapters, whatever you wanted. And it was great. It made apps grown up, I think.
Yeah, I see
what we're left with now. We've got Angular seems to have fallen by the wayside, and really when there are others, obviously, and Ember being one of them. React honestly seems to be the framework of choice for large organizations. Mm. Even they have struggled with the fast deployment, the new versions, the new releases, and so on. I also used Ember for a couple of years, and in that time, watched the changes within the Ember framework itself. They moved to writing a lot of their internals in TypeScript to give better debugging options for their own guys. And slowly now we're seeing that move into the more and more parts of Ember, the framework itself. And as we make a move ourselves to switching to TypeScript, maybe as a more structured programming language, I think that we'll start to reap those benefits. I haven't had enough hands-on experience on the likes of Angular and React to be able to comment too closely on how rapidly even they're changing. But when you see just regular Hacker News and Slashdot and all of the various blogs, that technology blogs, even the mainstream tech blogs. They're constantly talking about new changes. I mean, the node environment and that whole ecosystem has sprung. I wouldn't say out of nowhere, but that's been embraced by back end guys, by front end guys as well now, and that's good. The difficulty, of course, with something a technology that's rapidly evolving is trying to pick which pony you're going to back.
I suppose with my ends though, you can have your cake and eat it. Yeah. So micro front ends, you know, you write a self-contained black box that can be in React. I could write an app in Ember, and we could just plug the React module in. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket. You can have a whole wealth of ecosystem of programming frameworks have been plugged into one. That's one big app. It's fantastic
because they're all because they are all talking in a standard way and it's well defined. And well, it's open source. These people are talking and communicating with one another, and maybe the reason that they've chosen to work on Ember development versus React development is because they didn't agree with something that was being done in the particular project of choice. But ultimately, you know, we're seeing that all of these frameworks seem to vie for space. Ember itself seems to be a lot less popular than it once was. Truth be told, you would struggle now to find an Ember role, I think, in London.
Absolutely, you would. React is everywhere. It's the new poster child for.
And this is the reason, like, it kind of affected my decision on the, because I was between two jobs, and one of them was doing Vue.js, the other one was doing React. And even though I wanted to go for the Vue.js company, I went for the React company because I knew that I knew that it was like the winning framework or library at the moment. So and I can tell you, it changes so quickly; it's crazy. I mean, as front end developers, we're all used to that, all the constant changes. But honestly, there are some days that I'm like, I can't keep up anymore. It's just too much. And the back-end developers are actually making fun of that. They're saying JavaScript just changes every single minute. But I guess it's part of the fun. Even though I get really annoyed sometimes, I think I now realize that it's actually a good thing and it's part of the fun. But now I'm thinking, have I actually made the right decision just to choose a company just because of the framework or the library? But I don't know. Only time will show if I've made the right decision or not. Vue is actually used a lot as well. You can get a job quite easily if you know Vue.js. So yeah, that's pretty good to know. So these days, if you have a lot of experience as programmers, if someone wants to start a career right now and they just finished uni, or they don't have to finish uni, they have a passion for programming, what's the advice you would give to someone that just wants to start either front end or back end development?
So there are quite a few companies that offer graduate schemes. They might say have a stand at a conference, or they may even go along to, you know, talks, meetups, that sort of thing, and have stands. They may go to trade fairs and have stands, which invite graduates along. Certainly, quite a few companies. I know friends who work for quite a few companies, and they have grad schemes as well. As has a grad scheme. The grads will come on, they'll get trained up in maybe one team, 3 months later go to another team. So they'll get a whole feel for different frameworks, different technologies, front end, back end, iOS, web, the works, and then they can choose where they want to settle down. I suppose it's like being a doctor. You know, you go around one ward, two wards, three different wards, try a bit of everything, and then work out where you want to specialise. It's much the same.
I don't know whether that's quite how doctors work. But I certainly, when I heard that your company was offering the graduate scheme, I think you mentioned it was a 2-year scheme, so something along those lines, some long amount of time. So they really do get a chance to immerse into a load of different areas. And when you think about what makes up a developer, a software engineer, it can be everything from the nitty-gritty front-end stuff that we do all the way through to deployment, to QA, to back-end architecture work and so on. So you don't want to make the wrong decision straight away. I think having a chance to immerse quite heavily in all those is good. So you talk about your own graduate scheme and the company that you're working for. And there are other companies that also do this, and there are companies that specialize, or they certainly used to specialize in taking new graduates, offering them a bit of structure and a bit of, well, they've kind of made the decisions for you by saying, well, look, these are the skills that you probably should look at learning, which is nice at that stage to be shown what things you need. And then they would mentor you for a period of time before then encouraging you under their guidance and in a contract role to continue through in a workplace for a period of time. Not quite as structured, I think, as the organised ones that, let's say, your company is working for. But these have been successful in the past as a way of introducing somebody new into the workforce, into the workplace.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I think that the advice that I would give them would be really to spend time looking at the skill that you want that makes you the happiest the most. Mm. So you, Dora, you said that you were concerned you were doing Vue on the one hand and yet you made the decision to flip to a React role. And you do keep talking about it from have I made the right decision joining this company? Well, I would say follow your heart for the skills that you like and that you enjoy doing the most. Mm. And if the company offers those, then consider that company. Rather than say, oh, I really want to work for Coca-Cola, what skills can I find that might work for the two of us?
I agree.
Yeah. Maybe you'll end up working for Coca-Cola eventually, but you should be following your heart because that's what you're going to be passionate about. And when you're first starting, you're prepared to put in silly hours. I can remember, you know, finishing work at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, and I still wouldn't be even leaving work officially until after midnight, because you just want to keep on going.
Yeah,
As I got older, I've got less and less enthused about doing that. But certainly the first 5 or 10 years of my career, I was really engaged, constantly engaged, wanting to learn more. And I think that if you can follow that when you're straight out of college, straight out of university, if you can follow that passion, go with that rather than try to marry yourself up to a particular employer. I think that
would be funny. It's funny you say that about getting a bit tired after 10 years. I've just hit the mark of my 10-year experience, maybe 11, I can't really. And, I think I kind of lost that passion and that I was very eager to just stay late at night to learn something and go to the office the next day and be like, okay, now I know this. And I used to work crazy hours just to learn something. I think I'm kind of losing that passion to work late in order to learn something. Do you think that comes back? Or, I mean, I get very defensive with my time now. Does it come back? Or
yeah, I think that can come. You certainly can do. Yeah, I think if either within the same company, if you discover something new or try a new thing, and you know, even if the company aren't doing it themselves, you might try it and then say, well, actually, I could fit this in at work, and then maybe say to the company, can I do this new thing? Can we use it? Can we try it? And if they take it up, then you've got this new thing to play, a new toy to play with. There are always new things to try, and you know, with, I suppose, web standards being what they are now, back in, 1999 when we first started, the standards were few and far between and they didn't change that often. Now you're getting a new thing out almost every week. You know, you've got new audio protocols. You can play with the webcam and from a web page. You can do so many things. And there's always something new to try, whether it's using Canvas or WebGL. The sky's the limit really now. And there are more forums, more coding competitions, more tech talks.
That is so true.
This is the best time as a front-end developer.
Yeah, one of the things that makes me passionate again is the community. It's crazy how helpful this community is, how amazing it is to be part of this community. I think it gets better with time.
Yeah, the meetups were the eye opener for me in London. These were for 2 or 3 months, 2 or 3 years rather, started going to them really on any topic that you wanted. If you wanted to have pizza and beer, you could go to a meetup almost any day of the week and find something of interest that would engage you for a few hours. Mm. So maybe after about 10 years or so, you may have lost that desire to stay at work learning new things. But I think that the desire to keep on learning is never really lost. I mean, you're an engineer. Engineers always want to learn, and we're constantly craving something new. I think that after 10 years, I think maybe your work-life balance kicks in and you realize, well, maybe I could find new experiences outside of work that are also new for me to learn. And for me, that was the meetups. That's really engaging. I think that you find other things that work for you. I've enjoyed because loads of people have enjoyed baking and cooking. I wouldn't say enjoyed necessarily. Loads of people have been involved in baking and cooking over this lockdown period. And I've really enjoyed the cooking side of things as well. And so I think that for me, I've had a lot more passion in cooking, showing some of that passion that maybe in the past would have been spent delving into all of the different array methods and various very specific and esoteric parts of JavaScript. I mean, JavaScript's 25 years old, so it's kind of like that rabble-rousy kind of, you don't have to listen to your parents anymore. You're constantly changing your opinion on things, and there's always something new. That's JavaScript for me. And so there's always something, even if, as Dan mentioned, it's to do more with the browser side of things, the ability to control a web camera or to look at the new sound API stuff. There's always something new to dig in. So you just have to find something that makes you enthusiastic to investigate it. And, you know, it might be you just have to find an opportunity. I think maybe, Dora, you've just realized that you can find some of your new bits of knowledge outside of work, and you don't need to be stuck at a desk to do that.
Oh, yeah. That part of the reason why I'm doing this podcast, I'm like, okay, I could enjoy doing that. And one of the main reasons why I started doing the podcast is I'm tired of listening to CEOs and super wealthy businessmen talking about how they created this super amazing tech company and how much money they're making. And I'm like, we should listen to the people that do the actual hard work behind those companies. You know, it's just everything now is like, oh, create your own app, create your own company, make money. I'm like, why are you presenting this as a good thing? Like the kids need to be the bosses now. You can't just start a job and be an employee. You have to like become the boss straight away in order to make money. And the kids think, oh, I need to start something on my own to become my own company and make a lot of money. And I'm like, no, not really. You need to see how these CEOs and these businessmen that have so much money, how they make money. It's because they are hiring people that do the hard work. So yeah, this is part of the reason why I started this podcast. So in terms of like the lockdown and how it's been treating you and what you've been doing, because one of the other reasons why I started this podcast is because a lot of people think that people that work in tech and specifically programmers are just these geeks, and we're all geeks about something. You can be a geek about, you know, cycling. They just do that all day and nothing else. And like you said, cooking is actually... Someone compared cooking to coding the other day. It's actually very similar things. What are you? I know that Dan has started running, and I know that Jeff, you started cooking, and you play games, right? Do you still play games, online games?
I'm not really a gamer. So when you get asked, do you play games? You know, you kind of either say I'm a gamer. I spend like 50 hours a day in a darkened basement, staring into a computer screen. I'm not a gamer, not like that, and I'm not a board gamer. I'm not a D&D sort of style person. But I have been playing one particular game, which is a web-based game, now for over a decade. And I originally started playing it because it was based in the web browser. It didn't have Flash. It was just HTML. So that's what I was doing in my job. And so I saw it as a way of how can I use my skills as a computer programmer to modify my experience of this game, you know, just to make it better. Because, of course, I felt I could make everything better. But doing so, I learned how to use PHP. I learned a lot more about... how to write extensions for browsers, how to write an extension or a plugin. And with that, of course, the whole ecosystem that brings. And I spent I still play this game, and I really enjoy it. It's more about the community, I think, than anything else, and that's probably true of most games. But for me, it was about playing a game that I could have much, much more of an involvement in. And that was, you know, I'd come home at the end of the day and sit down at my desk at home and pretty much start doing the same things as I was just doing at work, but now not for money, just for fun. So in that respect, I'm a gamer, and I play one game. And that game, for anyone who's interested, is a game called Pardis. It's a 2D spaceship simulation game.
Oh, okay.
Not really all that exciting, but it's more about the community than it is about.
So and for you, I suppose it's a chance to develop code for the game. So you could, somebody might want a tool to map a certain sector or so on, and it's great to write tools.
Well, that's right. The game itself has got a concept of taxation, where you're taxed. Managing tax for a large group of people is very difficult when you've got very, very primitive tools, and the game itself offers very, very primitive tools. So it's also very, very easy then to create an extension or an add-on to that game, just which it still does the same things, but it just does them in a nicer way. Yeah. One button rather than pressing the same button 100 times. Little things like that, which from a programming point of view, you want to make your life a little bit easier, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I enjoy it for that. The challenge for me is not the game playing. The challenge for me is how can I make this just a little bit easier for other people, or how can I make it a little bit better for me?
So, and Dan, my internet is a bit slow, I think. This is the good thing with having four flatmates. so... Basically, and then Dan, did you start running before the lockdown or during the lockdown?
I've been running since
your 40th birthday.
My 40th birthday, yeah. So we were out at a restaurant on my 40th birthday with a couple of friends. One who used to be in the army, and he used to be super fit, running all the time, and came back to civilian life, and then. Sort of didn't exercise a huge amount, and he just started getting back into it. And he said to me, "Do you want to give it a go?" And I thought, "Well, midlife crisis. I'm just turned 40. Why the hell not?" And so 2 days later, I got a cold start in the morning, 6 a.m. downstairs, probably raining, and I've never been so unfit, and it just went from there. So since 2014, I've been running. Yeah, on and off. It's kind of a summer activity for me. Obviously, it started very slowly because I was a complete wreck and not used to any physical exercise. Coding is a very sedentary job, amongst other things. So, and slowly, I started running either faster or further, and it kind of built up. But it was always a summer activity. As soon as October, November came around, who wants to get up at five or six in the morning when it's pitch black? It's really hard to do and be motivated. And so I would have 6 months off and 6 months on. And of course, the 6 months over Christmas, I'd be feasting and whatever else, or on a holiday in New Zealand, and no one wants to run the holiday. So I'd undo the last 6 months' work and get unfit again. But this year, I think with the lockdown, it, to start with, because working from home was just getting too samey, switching the running from in the morning before work to lunchtime really helped break the day up for me. So I was very happy to, to sort of have this excuse to leave the house, I suppose. And now this year, I've been quite well over the last Christmas, I've been fortunate that my running partner has, was happy to run over winter as well. And so it's been really great to keep the continuation, for more than 6 months.
So you've gone from running, I know that you used to run regularly 5 kilometers, and then last year you did a 10 kilometer challenge.
My first 10k was 2019, so the London 10k. And I trained for about 2 months and I was so nervous, and now I'm running 10k in the morning just before work just because. That's happy good. Days I'm quite happy with it.
That's the thing about running the first few times. That's fine. You're doing the cooking because after the running, you need I need someone to cook for me after the run. but with running is like when you start, you're like, how do people do this every day? It's horrible. Why do people do this? And it's kind of boring. Like to me, even I've been doing it for a few years, but it's still quite boring. That's why I do like cycling as well, just to spice it up a bit. But I think once you get into it and you start slowly becoming better, you're becoming a geek. That's why I'm a geek when it comes to running now. As I come back, I check my data. I'm putting it on Strava every day. I'm just checking exactly my heart rate and how I can improve my heart rate and all this stuff. And it has become quite a game. And right now I'm like, I wish I worked for a company to like code and create all these like running applications. I guess I can, but yeah, I don't know. I guess I have to look for it. But that's very,
they're kind
very
of gamified.
Yes, they are. Apps,
gamified, they're social. So Strava's got the social aspect. Any running app really is gamification, because you're just looking, oh, last week I did it in 19 minutes. Now I'm going to try 18 and a half. And you just, as soon as you see numbers, I guess it's human nature. You're going to want to try and do better at something.
That's so true. Yeah, it's crazy how people think that tech people are just like in front of a computer all day doing nothing. And I just want to show the world that, like, we even had a colleague, Christian. I had a colleague, Christian, that's actually like a professional cyclist at the same time. Or I had another colleague that was a bodybuilder. We're not just geeks that sit in front of a computer all day and do just that, you know, we do other stuff. I'm really a
professional bodyboarder.
He
did the sort of mini windsurf boards, so the paddle boards, bodyboards, yeah. And he was, I think, one of the UK champions, possibly. Mm-hmm. It was, yeah, and yet turn up to work and do Java development. It's such a
crazy,
yeah, it's such a crazy mix.
Yeah. So, guys, when are you thinking of moving to New Zealand then? And are you going to work there, or are you going to just retire?
Well, I suppose it depends on the pandemic, obviously. But I've always thought that while I can work and I have the facilities to work and, you know, I'm able to work and I'm enjoying working, I should stay working. And if London, because until last year I was a contractor, London is where the IT contracts were. No one really would say, yeah, sure, you can have this contract in the other side of the world. It just wouldn't work, okay. I think. But since going permanent, and certainly now with the pandemic, when a lot of people are working remotely, most people are working remotely, the fact that I'm sitting in front of a desk on a work laptop coding, it doesn't matter whether I'm doing it in London or America or New Zealand. It shouldn't matter. So as long as I'm putting the hours in, and if anything, it almost the company might be, you know, getting a benefit of me being in New Zealand, because they'd have this kind of 24-hour turnaround. So I could do work during their nighttime and hand it over to someone in the daytime. So certainly they wouldn't be losing out. So I think that it would be nice if ultimately I could move to New Zealand while still working as an employee for the same company and you know, work remotely. That would be fantastic. So we're gonna attempt to try it at Christmas, at least for a month or so, you know, just go on a holiday, but also do a couple of weeks work either side of the holiday from the other side of the world and then see how it works. And if it works for me and it works for them, I mean, there are two or three other Kiwis on the team and they're all happy to you know, try the same thing. If we could all just go and start an office in New Zealand, you know, for example, it would be happy days.
It's crazy how many Kiwis are actually moving back to New Zealand. Some of my, I lived in a place about a year ago. No, when the pandemic started anyway, my neighbors were all Kiwis. About five or six of them, and they all moved back to New Zealand. It's the place to be right now, isn't it?
Oh, well done to them. The thing is, for the first year, they've done really well, and I think that there are some of the cracks are starting to show. I grew up in New Zealand, and I'm really, really proud to be a New Zealander, and I'm definitely going back. But I don't think I would say that it would be as a result of this particular pandemic and the likes, although I think for a lot of Kiwis, that is the cause for them to go back. New Zealand has had its first community transmission just recently, which is a bit of a problem. They've had a quarantine system, which means that everyone coming into the country has to stop take 14 days out of the quarantine thing, but even that managed to fail in this particular instance. And so, I mean, they'll figure that out as well. As you say, the Prime Minister, she seems to have really done a great job bringing the country together. So it's a lovely place to be. And in terms of retirement, I think it's a really nice place to retire too. Obviously, having grown up there, I know a lot more about it, and I'm comfortable returning there in my old age. But the problem is always going to be when you're towards the end of your career, or at the very least, when you're in the middle of your career, trying to plan when is the right time. So you've asked us, when are we going to move? And I guess ultimately for us, it's about making sure that we don't fall foul of any rules and regulations that might change in New Zealand. In our case, we need to make sure that we're there by the time you're 55 or something like that, to ensure that Dan can contribute enough to the economy to ensure a pension payout at the end of the day. But honestly, probably within 4 or 5 years, we have asked ourselves why we are still here. We're here because we love the food. We love the restaurants. We love the pubs. We love the socializing. We love the meetups. And, you know, all of these things have not been happening for about a year or so, not regularly anyway. Yeah, true. And I can't see them returning, not as they were anyway. They will return. But do we want to wait a couple of years for that? Or do instead we want to go to New Zealand and keep on doing those things? Because we might not have all of the nice restaurants that we really love over here, but there will be the nice restaurants over there that we haven't discovered yet. So
there'll be some pretty good restaurants for sure.
But and it's going to be exactly the same as working here, just without the pandemic, really.
Yeah.
It does have obviously cases, as you say, but it's certainly less locked down at the moment, or rather they don't have a lockdown. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I'm definitely going to visit you. I'm definitely going to visit you when you go. All right, guys.
You know, I think you'll be more than welcome.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I think we've been talking for quite some time now. Thank you so much for answering my questions. You have given some valuable advice and information about what's going on in the programming world right now in London. Thank you so much for this. And I will definitely come and interview you again in New Zealand, and we'll do this face-to-face.
Perfect.
That sounds
great. Thanks, Dora.
Thank lovely, you. Lovely to speak with you as well.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for listening this week's podcast. If you could leave a review in iTunes or your feedback about the show, that would be highly appreciated. Thank you so much.